Welcome to the American Shakespeare Center's Blackfriars Backstage Pass, All's Well That Ends Well, part of the ASC's 2010 spring season. We hope you enjoy this backstage look at the ASC's production of William Shakespeare's All's Well That Ends Well, now playing on the stage of the American Shakespeare Center's Blackfriars Playhouse in Stanton, Virginia.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the American Shakespeare Center podcast on William Shakespeare's All's Well That Ends Well. This particular program is dedicated to Sam Coogler, who is always here to do these things and to record them, and who is our go-to person in so many ways. And we here at the American Shakespeare Center would be much more like the American Shakespeare Corner if it wasn't for Sam Coogler. Thank you, Sam, for all you do. I want to introduce the cast, and so reading on your iPod, on your little circle thing from I'd say 9 o'clock around to 3 o'clock, the following people will introduce themselves and the parts that they play, and we'll start with Jenna.
Hi, I'm Jenna Hoban. I play Helena in this production of All's Well That Ends Well.
Hi, my name is Aidan O'Reilly, and I play Bertram.
My name is Rick Blunt. I play Parolles.
Dennis Henry, I play the King of France.
And my name is Ralph Cohen, and I play the director of Mission and the co-founding executive director of the American Shakespeare Center. I just finished writing something about what a bad title Henry IV Part II is, what a nightmare it is for marketing. You know, I want to sell you a play. It has Roman numerals in it. And then we find out, and in addition to that, it's part two. And it's a nightmare for a great play. And I was thinking while I was writing this thing that, you know, I'm not insulting Shakespeare, because it's pretty clear Shakespeare had nothing to do with creating that title. And then I started thinking, what titles did he create? And I think that there's a good article in this for somebody who needs tenure somewhere, and that would be, you know, which titles belong to Shakespeare and which don't. And I think it's only the comedies that I would get behind as his. And partly because you get in the titles of these plays some of that amazing irony, you know, that you get. You know, So Much Ado About Nothing is an amazing thing for an author to have written as a title for his play. Henry Fielding, there's a moment in Tom Jones when Henry Fielding has his narrator gives the opening sort of chapter of each of the 18 books of Tom Jones, which is one of the great novels ever written, and it's a great comic novel. And at the very beginning of each of these books, and they're great because the chapters, like each chapter, you know, they have like 12 chapters, and each chapter is just about how long you need in the bathroom. So it's an extremely wonderful book to put in your john and grab whenever you want. But he says at one point, after I think it's the 7th introduction, a dear reader, I don't know if you've noticed, but really there's no plot at all in these opening chapters of the book. You can ignore it altogether. And then later he has a chapter called About Little or Nothing. And he's really stealing from William Shakespeare. Shakespeare's title, All's Well That Ends Well, strikes me as proof of his having written it because of the sort of wonderful way in which that title plays. And by the way, it's a marketer's dream. The play, however, whatever challenges it provides, a marketer loves that, because All's Well That Ends Well is a title that's come into our usage, like, you know, Comedy of Errors, where we just use it as part of our language now. So I thought I would start with that and ask a couple of questions about it. The ending of the play, in which all four of you are involved, and how you think things end up as your characters. If we could start there. And it is the story of this woman, and I think in many ways one of the first, you know, truly modern heroines in literature, who is a middle-class woman who's brought up in the home of a nobleman, has been brought up with him, loves him as you would from propinquity, but also loves him, is in love with him, and with the blessing of his mother goes after him, works a deal on the king who's got who's dying of a fistula, which is an abscess of the anus, and she fixes that with a special medicine her father had. Her father was a doctor. We have to remember that being a doctor in the 16th century, 17th century is the equivalent of being a barber. It's not really very high, but this was a good doctor, and he had this special medicine for anal afflictions. Oh. And she fixes that, and what she wants as a reward is for the king to give her whatever bachelor in the country she wants. And the one she wants, of course, is the one she grew up with, Bertram, which Aidan plays. So she does that. And the only thing is that Aidan wasn't consulted, or rather Bertram, and Bertram's not at all happy with this deal. And I would argue, this is just me, I would argue, as would nobody would be, no nobleman would be very happy with this deal, except insofar as it would please the king. And so he runs away. She goes after him, and she tricks him into bed with her because he's kind of given the sort of challenge that he'll be her husband the day she can prove that she's
the
mother of his child. And so she works that out, and then at the end of the play, confronts him with her pregnancy and after doing a lot of really kind of sleazy things to deny it, he says okay, and then we have this title, All the Well That Ends Well, and a lot of people have argued that it's ironic, but I would like to know how you guys, as your characters, kind of where you feel you are in relation to that title when the play is over. So we'll start with the highest person in the play, the king, and that's Dennis. Yeah.
Well, from the perspective of the king, he's the one who declares everything is all right. The last lines are, if it ends so well, the bitter past, more welcome is the sweet. So yeah, all yet seems well, and if it ends so, I don't know. I don't know these lines. I'll do them soon. all yet seems well, but if it ends so meet the bitter past, more welcome is the sweet. And so from his perspective, everything has been put back in order. What he declared is together. The people who are together should be. Parolis has found redemption. And I have now Diana and her mother. I found two more people who I'm going to raise up their status and welcome them to the court.
So you would say that from the point of view of whether or not it's a mistake to sort of marry people off to noblemen who are not noble themselves, you haven't exactly learned a lesson.
Right.
Would that be a fair statement?
Yeah. The king decides everything is so good that he decides it wasn't even a mistake to set
right,
this emotion.
Right.
He's going to do
say,
it again.
And really from our perspective, from a modern contemporary perspective, it's probably a mistake. But it's really maybe not from the other perspective, and I think it's quite right that you wouldn't see it as having been a mistake, especially since it all came out so well.
It is interesting. It's often a laugh line when I offer a husband to Diana.
Yeah.
It's pretty consistent.
Right. I mean, I think that there's a similar thing that goes on in Romeo and Juliet where it's only a little bit, and I'm not sure whether or not it's still in our show, but at the very end where the two families say, well, I'll build a tomb even better than your tomb. So the feud's over, but it's not. They're already competing on that. Okay, well, you mentioned Parolis. And I didn't mention Parolis in the narrative because this is really not a play about Parolis. No, but it is in many, many ways.
Filler, sir.
He's the comic figure. Can you sort of tell the audience what it is that's going on in your mind at the end of this play?
Well, I don't. Yeah. Well, here's the deal. Parolis, when you meet him, I think he's living pretty high on the hog. And I think he's got there by lying. I mean, that's all. I mean, you know, that's how it is. So he gets discovered. He gets humiliated. And then after being kind of happy to be out of his responsibilities, he then doesn't know how to live. And that's where, well, really, LeFou says, you know, wait on me home. Like, I'll take care of you. I'll make sport with you. Like, so then, like, it's kind of like, as a child sometimes or as a kid, like, you have a problem, you know, and it works you up so bad. And your parents say, like, don't worry. Like, it's going to be fine. Like, it's kind of all's well that ends well. You know, you're like, why aren't you more worked up about this? Like, Mom, like, I'm really fired up. Like, at the end of this play, Paroli's in a good place. He's in a much better place than he was. You know, he's in a place where he's less responsible for things, and now he can eat. Like, so that's the sort of thing. That's exactly where he belongs, I think. So the journey is of, you mentioned redemption. Like, I think that, like, everything is well for Paroli's at the end of this play.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you could make the case that Paroli's, like many comic characters, he's sort of like Don Armato. He's sort of like Falstaff. He is the braggart soldier figure. That's the braggadocio, and he's been found out, and he's like, okay, you found me out. And if you've got a place for me, LeFou, I'll take it, no matter how you've insulted me in the past, and I'd be glad to take it. I think you're one of those characters, your character who does change in the course of the play. I mean, you learn something. I love your line after they've tricked you and you say, who may not be? What's the line? Who may not be? Who may not be?
Who cannot be crushed with a plot?
Who cannot be crushed with a plot?
I'll tell you what my favorite line is. My favorite line. Paroli says, if my heart were great, 'twould burst at this. And I think I said it wrong anyway, I don't want to admit it to the people. But if my heart were great, 'twould burst at this. You know, he gets found out. Like, if I cared, like, this would kill me.
Yeah.
But I don't care. You know, not that he doesn't care. He just doesn't want to be a captain. You know, he doesn't.
Well, I mean, another way to read it, and that's great, and it pushes me back always to Much Ado when Don Pedro says his heart, he suddenly realizes something, and his heart does something to him. And you say, essentially, if I had a great heart, a brave heart, if I were a bigger man.
Yeah.
I would be, and I'm recognizing I'm not a very big man on some level, that I don't have a big heart. So I don't think it's just that you're saying you don't care.
I imagine
that a person with a greater heart would really be embarrassed about this and crushed, but I'm not particularly. Yeah. And so you're making the best of what you got.
Yeah.
So that brings us, I actually want to save Bertram. Okay. And so, Helena, you get what you wanted. Mm-hmm. How does the title?
Well, for as long as I'm playing this role, I have to believe that this is the happy ending that I'm after, and that there's hope, and that there's something really good in the future. You know, what were this play to continue after those final lines? I like to believe that it's going to be well, and that is sort of how I get through every performance, is the belief that something really great will come out of this. But I believe for our audience, the only way to sort of come on board with me is this, they have to believe in a paradigm shift, which is to say that Helena and Bertram had this relationship as children. They have the relationship that our audience views, and then they're going to have a third relationship after that. And we, Helena and Bertram, and anybody who's watching our story, has to believe in a shift of paradigm, which is also, I think, true in our lives. You know, I have a friendship with each one of my cast members. And this was built on a relationship that was a first impression. At one point, we had a first impression. And sometimes it's a negative one, and sometimes it's a positive one. And then sometimes that changes over the course of time, and sometimes changes a lot, several times. And when I look back on some first impressions that I had, the relationship, it's like a different person. It's like the friendship that I'm remembering was a friendship with a different person, because the friendship I have with that person now is so evolved. So that's what I like to believe about Helena and Bertram. It's sort of a rebranding of a person. And that when I look at this man, this character, but Aiden playing Bertram at the end of the play, I look at his face and believe, well, here's our new life together. What is this? And an exciting thing about the plot is that I get to believe that something has changed, because we've had this little switcheroo in the dark. We've had this event that can be that paradigm shift, to put it. Well, that wasn't even that blunt. I could be more blunt. But
yeah, how good was it?
How good was it? And if this is the moment when Bertram discovers, you're the woman that came into my room, or you're the woman whose room I came into? Oh, well, maybe there is more there than I thought. And, there's this line in Tennessee Williams, there are things that happen between a man and a woman in the dark that sort of make everything else all right. I might be paraphrasing that. Forgive me,
that's
Tennessee.
Good.
But I do think that that has to play a part in it too. So we have a childhood, we have this plot you see, we have this life-changing event, this paradigm shift, and we can look at each other in those final moments with new eyes.
Okay. I like that. When I worked on the play in, 2005 with Stephen Booth, which was, every day a great, huge learning experience, because he knows so much about the text. He said to the actors, look, it has a happy ending. It's a fairy tale. It has a happy ending. And that's what we're going to look for. And we're not going to try to worry about what the critics all write about, because this is a happy ending. And if people feel it isn't, it won't be because we didn't play it as a happy ending. We're going to play it as a happy ending. And but that brings us to Bertram. Mm-hmm. And I thought I'd finish with you, because, you're the one pinned like a butterfly or a caterpillar or a worm into an exhibit case there at the end of the play. Tell me about your feelings about the ending.
It changed dramatically from reading it to the first time we were up on our feet with it. Because that whole last act for Bertram, or that last scene rather, is he really doesn't know what's going on. Because he has this ring, which he thinks he got from Diana, which the king actually gave to Helena, and Helena gave to him in the dark. So he has no idea that Helena has any connection with this ring, and then all of a sudden everyone's saying, no, this was my ring, this is my ring, this is my ring. So that's strange enough. And then this girl that he's kind of screwed over shows up with her mom, and everyone is accusing him. He's sitting in this corner. And I think really he does try to lie. I would argue who wouldn't if you were 16, 17. And finally, I think at the end, he just sees a chance to just either get things right and or get out of it, both of which are good things.
Yeah.
How much he means that last sentence or that last thing he says, I love thee ever, ever dearly, is, I think, up for serious debate.
How much do you mean it when you say it?
I believe I mean it when I say it. But Bertram does that a lot, I think, says something and fully means it and then goes and does the opposite. So I don't know, as if it's a happy ending for me at the end, I think it's just a relief.
as you may know or not, I directed this thing in '87 with Jim Warren as Lavage. I don't know if y'all know that. When he was
we did not know that.
No,
thank you.
You did not know that.
No.
Yeah, and Jim was. This is not about Jim. Jim was fine. He was a good Lavage. It's a very hard part, I think, because that is one sort of unfunny clown, if ever there was one. But the guy that played. The guy that played Bertram for us, who later played a just wonderful Macbeth that Jim directed in one of the early days of SSE, a man named Darren Setlow, told me during the rehearsal that once he got on his feet, he said, Ralph, I just want you to know, because I was doing what I've been reading the critics, and I was far, I have learned a lot since 1987, And I have been reading the critics, and so I thought this was a problem play, and I wanted to deal with it as a problem play, which you should never do. I mean, the play is the play, and the only problem with it is critics, really. So I had been sort of pushing that, you know, that she, that at the end here is this loathsome guy, and she's stuck with him. It was also a feminist reading of it. And, like, at the end, I had her sort of migrate on stage over to the countess so that two women are together and not toward her husband, you know, sort of indicating that it's not going to be a happy 40 years for this guy after this finish. But Darren Setlow said to me, Ralph, I just want you to know, after what I just went through, I mean it with all my heart. My world has been turned upside down, and I mean it. And I just thought that was interesting. And so this is twice I've heard someone say that who's playing the part, that there's enough pressure at the end there to do that. And I think something else you said that I think is interesting. You said other people would do it too. I actually think that. And this comes from my reading of the selection scene. You know, I think Bertram gets points for saying what he really thinks, because I don't think the other suitors are particularly happy about this. Now, that's my reading based on what LeFou is telling us these guys are doing. And I feel like I like Bertram a lot for at least standing up to the – I mean, he stands up to the king. Yeah. And I think that shows something. And then – and then he's going to keep his, you know, he tells his mom what he really thinks, and then he runs away. But there's a kind of real clear post-adolescent that I believe in, and that I think all of us are, that I think is there. And so I completely agree with what you say. And who wouldn't, in the circumstances, who wouldn't try to wiggle out of this impossible trap they're in?
Is that what the countess says to the... Yeah, she says to me, it's a natural rebellion born of youth. Please forgive it.
Yeah. And she's one smart lady, too. I mean, she's somebody, you know, there are very few characters in Shakespeare that you can just say, like, bank on as sort of an avatar for wisdom. And she's one of them. She's one of those few characters that you kind of can bank on. That's a good point. Okay. So I'm sorry. I have talked much more than I normally do, but I'm very excited about the play and wanted to talk. I want to ask this question. I frequently ask, what's the moment you look most forward to playing in your role in this? And I will ask that. But before that, I'd like to ask the opposite question. What's the moment you're concerned about the most? And it can be as specific as you want, right down to a word, syllable, or movement. That when you're backstage and you know, oh, well, here comes, or you know it's coming, you're concerned to get it right, if you think you ever have, or you think you never have, or whatever. Anybody can.
I get. Well, the nice thing about this play is that, from my perspective, it's a nice strong through line, and when I get on that train, if I start it out right, then it feels like the moments are pretty easily achieved. I think I would have answered this differently a few months ago and would have said that the hardest part is at the end of our first act, toward the end of the first act, and I basically am speaking to an invisible Bertram and saying, don't go to war, come back. I'd rather have you here and me absent than you there and potentially dead. And so it's an emotional height, it's a difficult... But I don't now believe that that's the hardest moment. I really think it's the very first moment when I step on stage, because it's wordless, but I have to feel in the right frame of mind. And if that's the case, then boom, Parolles is on stage. There's a comic scene that happens, and then I have this challenge ahead of me. And then it's brilliant in its construction that I really get to just walk upstairs. So for me, it's the very first instant.
So when you say get it right, can you break that down? Can you deconstruct that just a little bit and tell me what that would mean?
Yeah,
for you?
Sure. It's a couple of things. You know, technically, the other characters refer to my crying. So technically, that would be great if I could have tears. And sometimes that is the case, but sometimes that is not the case. And then you're doing technical things to cry for your fellow actors to justify their line. But more, I think, more internally, more artistically, whether there are tears there or not is – I talk about this sort of horizontal draw toward – my fellow actor. That means that wherever Bertram is on stage, that's where my focus is. I know there's other talking going on, but my focus has to be on him, and it should be all positive, which is, don't go, because I love you, and you're great, and I want you to be here. And if you must go, then good for you, but I will love you the whole time. And it's sort of an internal monologue that I have to maintain. And if I hit it right, then I'm there and I can just sail. And if not, then it feels like every scene I have to sort of reset myself to begin at the right place. Is that what
gotcha.
You meant?
No, it's really interesting. It's very clear. And
okay.
My question would be this. And I'm one of my major interests is how audiences respond to things. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, how many times have y'all done this show all together so far?
30?
Between 25 and 30.
Okay. Can you correlate your thinking either that it's right, you got it, and the way the audience is responding, or that it's wrong and the way the audience – do you have a correlation there, or do you think this is purely personal?
I think it's purely personal this time in referring to Helena in All's Well That Ends Well. And I wouldn't say that about every single play and every single role. I think certain ones have a different science behind them, or certain chemistry that make them work for me and work for the audience simultaneously. And I don't believe that to be true here. I think there are times when there's this one line that I have in that scene that I talked about being so difficult. And I'm reading this letter that is from my husband, and I get the news that... the line that I referred to, till I have no wife, I have nothing in France. And in reference to that, I then say, 'tis bitter. No, I know what it is. This is a dreadful sentence. And it frequently gets a laugh. And I was so shocked when it happened. But it's sort of like Adriana in The Comedy of Errors. And Ralph, you and I have talked about this before, which is Adriana doesn't know she's in a comedy.
Right.
Well, either does Helena.
Right.
So Helena says this thing. The audience knows other stuff. If they laugh at that, that's fine. That's great.
It is.
But I have to divorce.
A great example.
You know what I mean?
That's a terrific example.
I do have to divorce myself from their experience and go on with this
monologue.
Yeah,
you're not playing the laugh. You can't play the laugh.
No.
No, because you mean it. This is a dreadful sentence.
I mean it.
It is a really bad sentence.
And sometimes those laughter, those moments when a character is in pain and the audience is laughing, fuels what comes next. Because there I am standing, and the lights are on at the Blackfriars, so I can see them laughing. And that's what I'm – you're laughing? Wait, there's more. Yeah. Listen to what I have to say next.
It's great. That's great. Anybody else? A moment of – anxiety about a particular thing that has to happen?
Yeah, the scene where Helena convinces the king to take her medicine is a really interesting scene. It happens fairly fast from when he goes from dismissing her to her bringing him around. And it's interesting to try and get that build of why haven't I thrown this person out yet? What is it about her that makes me listen?
Where's the turn? Because Vanessa Marasco played it in the 2005 thing, and I actually remember that her saying the very same thing. And so we worked on that with Keegan. And I'm trying. Why does he shift?
When she said, upon thy certainty and confidence, what darest thou venture? And she lists things and finishes with, take my life. If you don't survive, I'll die too.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's pretty convincing.
And we found something interesting within the text, the rhyme scheme in that scene is wonderful because the king dismisses her with a rhyming couplet to go. And then she starts rhyming back. And then he gives in a shared line, he gives her a chance to complete his rhyme. And the more complicated it gets, the more she becomes confident and the more he becomes convinced. So that was a real exciting thing to find in that. But it's always is sort of a weird thing to play because it has to be a subtle progression to then be completely convinced. And it's I'm always conscious of that one.
We that was another thing. Yes. And I recommend anybody that's interested in the way rhyme is giving instruction look at that, because the way she's willing to do that, because it's an assertion of some sort of equality when you start rhyming back at a king. And of course, you guys have it in Romeo and Juliet, where Lady Capulet insists on throwing them back at the prince, and everybody's up there sort of in a rhyme competition. So yeah, that's really good. And Richard II is another one where, you know, somebody comes in and gives him a couple of couplets, and so he knocks off a quatrain and a, you know, it's like, don't come in here rhyming at me. So we worked on, yeah, that's another thing in a moment in there that is really interesting, where she's showing you something. And again, and I go back to Romeo and Juliet, since it's in your season, it's also, he gives a quatrain to her, and when he first speaks to Juliet, and she gives one back, and we're in a different ball game than we were before. So that's wonderful. Anybody else?
I want to know what are you getting at with it? What do you want? I have anxiety moments, but I don't know, why are you looking for them? That's my question.
Oh, because I feel like that's a great way to get everybody backstage with you guys. I mean, that's the name of this thing.
Well,
you know, it's like, what is the actor? What is the actor? You know, I want to remind our readers, and I think this is probably part of our mission, that these things are plays and they're put on by actors. And if there's a greatness in Shakespeare, it is partly that he understood that somebody else was going to complete him. That's his greatness. So nothing's fixed. It's like the opposite of Shaw, where everything is absolutely nailed shut. And it's wonderful and it's great, but it's always Shaw. With Shakespeare, it's Shakespeare plus the chemistry of your anxious moment. Go.
Yeah, or in my, I have two. One is the entrance of Bertram, LeFou, and Parolles after the king has been healed. And we have this strange one-upsmanship conversation where, you know, LeFou comes out and, you know, says, like, these things, we should submit ourselves to these things and not, you know, and there's this weird one-upsmanship moment where, like, I have to say the same thing four different times, like, oh, I would have said it, and I would have said the very same, and so say I too, and too, you know, like that moment is really weird. And it's really weird because backstage, I know the king is changing. They're about to come out. I've got to take the time, and there's a trumpet cue. That's my line. So, like, if I don't get these things right, and I have to say the same thing four times in a row in different words, which repetition, in other words, is also known as accumulatio, by the way, the rhetorical device. Let me just throw that
somebody's
out there.
Somebody's been at the very best program there is.
One, that's just a technical. It's from a memorization standpoint and a feel standpoint where, like, if you trip up, you're going to trip up not only timing of that trumpet, but also the entrance of the king and what they are doing. So there's a moment that is – and it's a bit – it's a – like, the moment, it's a little unclear of what we're talking about. Like it's a strange thing to be – it's just like, what did he say? Well, I would have, like
– you're agreeing with him no matter what he says. It's a little bit like when Hamlet tells Polonius – that cloud looks like a humpback whale or whatever.
Right,
so,
and that's what I would have said.
You just said, yes, exactly.
So there say too. Yes, yeah, yes. It's such a strange moment.
Then your other one?
The other moment, which is purely an acting moment, like they say, let's get him to fetch his drum. The two soldiers are out with Bertram, and they're like, "I know how we can prove his mettle to you. Like we wish you knew him the way we did. Like we can have him protest to get this drum back, this drum that he's lost in battle." So like, in I come, and the scene, you know, they're like, we've lost our drum. You know, I'm like, well, we could have got it back. You know, it might have been recovered. You know, and it is to be recovered, says Parolles.
All right,
but. That the merit of service is seldom attributed to the true and exact performer. There's a strange, like this scene has to end with the audience thinking, I'm going to get this drum. But the way that it ends, there's a comic moment like we try to put in where Parolles says, you know, I love not many words, which is this awesome line. And it can get a laugh if done right. But I have screwed it up so many times. It's a really difficult moment in there to be excited about something that you're going to lie about. Like there's a strange
right into what Aidan was saying about Bertram. I don't think you're exactly lying when this stuff happens. You know, I can do that, you say, and then why did I say that?
Right.
You know, why
right.
in the world did
what
I say
the devil?
That? Yeah, yeah. So I don't think you, I think when people see you do it, nobody's worried about it because they kind of know, yeah, I could do that. And why did I say that? Damn it.
Right.
I wish I hadn't said that because it's because your mouth starts running.
And, yeah, and that's exactly what he explains it as. Yeah. You know, Paroli says, my tongue is too foolhardy.
Yeah.
But it's still a hard moment. Those two moments are hard for me. Those are my two hardest moments in this play. When I think about them, I'm like, argh.
All right, well, y'all start, while Aiden is telling us about his difficult moment, y'all start thinking about your favorite thing. The thing you can't wait for. The thing you say, oh, we're doing All's Well tonight, and I get to do X. So think what X is. Aiden?
Well, it's funny. I thought, again, reading it, I thought that the hardest thing would be that ending. But that's never felt hard. But what is hard, I got into an argument once with an actress friend of mine where I said I thought Ophelia was a harder part than Hamlet because all of her big changes happen off stage. And all of a sudden, after you haven't seen her for a while, she comes in mad. Well, Hamlet, you're kind of with him the whole time, so you can act your way through it. And there's this one moment with Bertram where I'm one of those actors who, yeah, I like to have this. It's easier for me to cry if I can build up to it on stage rather than having to go off stage and then enter crying. I find that very difficult because when you're off stage, you see everyone running around, and I'm easily distracted at the best of times. So there's this one moment where actually I have to leave very upset after the king has said, you're marrying Helena. And I said, okay, and I leave. And then Le Fou and Proles have kind of a funny scene, and then I have to come back on even more upset. And it's about 3 pages, I think, I wait. And I'm sitting there trying to work myself up into this frenzy, which, of course, you're never going to achieve if you sit there trying to do it. It will either happen
or
it won't.
And your opening line in that moment is?
Undone and forfeited to cares forever. And I come kind of bawling through the middle of the discovery space. And I think it's a weird moment for the audience, too, because I've just had this kind of funny scene. And
They just had the funny scene,
which I haven't. And then actually, your reaction is kind of comic. And I think it is. I mean, I like how it's staged. It's just strange to act. I think it does make sense, and it's how the moment is written.
But from inside, it feels very awkward.
It's tricky. Yeah.
Undone. Like all the children in London.
Oh.
Okay. So can we go to scenes you can't wait to do?
Yeah. I'm lucky. I've got so many great scenes. And one of the things that I like about playing this role is that it really feels like a vehicle for truth. I really feel like I can just speak truthfully in all these scenes. And that's a gift. But my favorite of them is my comic scene with Paroli's Mr. Ricklin right here. And part of it, I think it's an oasis in the sense that it is my comic scene in this play. Aside from that, I really have a whole lot of comedy to do. It's a lot of truth and a lot of connecting, but this play is rich with acting and two-handers for me. So I get a two-hander with each one of these men that is just great. It's great to be able to do your work with one set of eyes, and then the scene lives right there between the two of them.
Well, is that what you mean by two-hander? What does that
mean? Yeah, two-hander, two people on stage, two people sharing the scene. And the scene with Paroli's is just funny. He gets all these punchlines, and then Helena gets all these punchlines as well. I feel really connected to Rick on that. I feel like we're always playing in the moment, and I kind of never know what's going to happen, which is delightful in its own way. And so it's a treat. It's just a treat.
Can I follow up on that? Because it is a treat, and it's lovely to watch you guys do it. So, but I have a question connected to the thing that you're concerned about,
mm-hmm.
which is this opening and how you're doing. Uh-huh. I mean, you just said this thing about horizontal. What was it? Horizontal attraction? Horizontal? What was
draw. I can't remember what I... Focus, maybe?
Yeah.
A horizontal
on,
pull.
On Bertram.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly you're in this sort of, I don't know, contest.
Banter.
Banter, very bawdy banter with this other character. How is that part of any arc?
Great question, Ralph.
Yeah.
Well, it does all have to tie back to Bertram. And I think a couple of things. This Helena is not without hormones. at all. And that's what she's thinking about, is her love for Bertram, when this guy comes on and says, "Are you meditating on virginity?" What a great opportunity for her to, you know, hear someone that will listen to what she's going through and wants to talk about it and will get bawdy with her. And she wants to play that game. And it's his best friend. So chances are really good that there's information here for her. Like, what does he know? What is he, what can, and what will he say? What will he repeat from this conversation to Bertram later? And then the final line, Paroli says to Helena.
No, it's such a, that was our hardest moment.
Get thee a good husband?
No, the moment where you go off right in front of him.
Exactly.
And, yeah, go ahead.
Well, that it's incredibly tricky. What I was referring to is his line, get thee, what is it, Rick?
Get thee a good husband and use him as he uses thee.
So farewell, and leaves. Paroles leaves Helena with that sentiment, get thee a good husband and use him as he uses thee. Which I think, boom, now we're back to Bertram. Now everybody knows, like, if we play that right, then the audience goes with us and now we're back to Bertram. But you're right, the next, that transition that follows, I think is, that probably is the hardest moment in Helena's
where
draft.
You go, where you have a sort of apostrophe. This is a long apostrophe, right? Yeah.
Yes. And you and the next thing is, our remedies often ourselves do lie, which we ascribe to heaven, which I think is an enormous leap. It's an enormous leap for her to having gone from that comic scene with Paroles into that monologue. And Rick and I have actually talked about this. And I think it's also an enormous leap for the audience to know where she's going. What is she talking about? She just finished that. So I think it's imperative that I have faith that they are coming with me. Because if I believe where I'm going and I know how I'm tying it all back in, hopefully they will too. And it might take them a couple of lines before they are on that train with me. But what I think the sense of it is, he says to me, get thee a good husband, and walks out. And what I say is, I will get me a good husband, and this is how.
Okay.
Boom.
Cool.
And then
that's,
I go.
Good. But I just thought of the place that I am curious about. Not my virginity yet.
There's another one.
Where he's just standing there for all those lines. And then you say, what one if faith? So, you know, that's also, it seems to me, that was that we struggled with
it's
that.
It's tough. The audience helps out in that one. That's one where, you know, I do believe that the character is not just standing there, but I wouldn't know because I'm not facing him, which is a nice trick, a nice directing trick that really comes in handy in some of this material, because it's simply focus. If Helena is focused out and giving this information to the audience, she doesn't know what Paroli's feeling or thinking.
And what are you thinking or feeling? I mean, sort of
in all those lines?
Stuck there with your thumb firmly wedged.
I'm just trying to get a better look at her. That's all. I mean, that's what Paroli's is thinking.
Okay.
I'm like, what?
What's going on?
I'm just getting a better look, and I'm obviously not listening to what she's saying. It's apparent in the lines, I think. Like, he's not really listening because she says, and he is one. I'm like, what one? Like, wait, what? Like, what are you talking about? Like, what one in faith? Like, I'm not listening to
you. All right. Anybody else? Favorite?
Oh, well, yeah. Well, yeah. I might as well jump on the back of Jenna's because it's going to make sense. Because, like, my favorite scene in this play to do is this virginity scene. And it, like, let me take you backstage, team. Let me take you backstage, people, listeners at home. Like, live theater. One of the great things about live theater is it's not the same every night. Okay? But we talked earlier about response. You got a responsibility to do things. Like, if your line cues the trumpet, then you got to say that line. Or they're not going to, that trumpet's not going to be cued, and then the king can't come in. I talked about it earlier. This scene every night does not have to be the same. And I trust Jenna Hoban. And I think she trusts me. But it doesn't have to be the same every night. If you want to try something new, you can try something new. Now, you can't always do that with every partner that you have. You can't do it. I mean it. Like, sometimes, luckily, we are in a position where we get to talk to one another and we care about what one another thinks and we want to give each other what one another wants while doing this scene. I mean, it's fun because it's funny. You know, it's a great scene. But it's more fun because I get to do it with Jenna Hoban and I can trust that if something new happens or if something crazy happens or if I get input from an audience member that I want to use, I know that if I use it and I look across the space at Jenna, she'll be there with me. Mm-hmm. And she'll understand why I did it. You know, like, if you, like, I was taught in theater that if you steal a scene from someone when you're not supposed to, you have to buy the other person a pop. You understand what I'm saying here? Yeah. Someone taught me that. A very smart and funny man taught me that. But, like, I've made mistakes in that scene, you know, and where, you know, like, or I'll try a different entrance and it gets too much laughter and it takes away from something else. And, like, because I think of our friendship and the respect we have for one another's work, like, we get a chance to talk about the things we need to talk about. And we find a way, and we're constantly talking about how that changes or where the pauses should be and who gets to laugh at what. And, like, wow, like, you get so much input on that funny scene. It's really hard not to want to talk about it, not to want to acknowledge it and want to be part of it. And, like, the audience has been great. And, like, but it's the part you don't see of why it's great is because of who it is for us. Like, we enjoy ourselves in that moment. I enjoy myself cool. because I get to work with her. And that scene is the bomb.
Okay. Somebody else?
My favorite part is, playing the king is one of my favorite characters I've ever played. It's just a human being that I like. In addition to some great words, it's like, I really respect this guy. And the speech that is just wonderful, I think, is one of the best in Shakespeare, is the title speech after Bertram has...
Really remarkable in a monarchist age.
Yeah.
That speech gets made.
Everyone created equal a couple hundred years before Jefferson. So
yeah, it's amazing.
It's just so beautifully put and so clearly put. And I'm always amazed that Bertram isn't convinced by the time I've finished that speech.
And Bertram.
Well, I really like playing Bertram. I think it's the closest I'll ever get to playing a leading man. And it's a lot of fun. What I like about, it's probably just true of good writing in general, and you just find this all the time in Shakespeare, is when you get a line that is phrased so perfectly, it's unimaginable to try to think of another way to say it, which makes paraphrasing difficult. But it's when I'm convincing Parolles to go after the drum, and I say, "Why, if you have the stomach to it, monsieur, if you believe your mystery and stratagem can bring this instrument of honor again into his native quarter, be magnanimous in the enterprise and go on." I just think, who wouldn't want to go get the drum after hearing that, you know? Yeah. So that kind of stuff I love. And then the scene with where Bertram is thinking he's won over Diana. Brandy Rome, who plays Diana, and I just have a great time every night. It's a really fantastic scene.
Yeah, the seduction only it isn't.
It isn't, yeah.
Well, we always end with, but y'all have already done some, and if you want to rest on what you've done, you can. But we end on favorite lines, and so you can do more of that, Dennis, if you want, or whatever. But something you really love in your mouth when you say it, and you just love the words. And I'll just say about the paraphrase exercise that you says, you know, when you paraphrase, you know, really one reason for the paraphrases is for actors to see that there really isn't a better way to say it, that it works, you know. And so it's great that you feel that way. Okay.
Well, I have this list that I think really – it is part of the scene with Parolles in the beginning of the play, and it's about Bertram and what I want to be to him. And it says – how does it start? There shall your master have a thousand loves, a mother and a mistress and a friend, a guide, a goddess and a sovereign, a counselor, a traitress and a dear, his humble ambition, proud humility, his jarring concord and his discord dulcet, his faith, his sweet disaster.
Wow, that's a great speech. But my favorite parts are traitorous and dear disaster. What do you think of those two words? Of those. Yeah, I'll be his traitorous and his disaster.
She'll go anywhere. Well, I love sweet disaster. I think if I if I had a T-shirt, a Helena T-shirt,
it would say
sweet disaster, because I think that's what this play is for me. It is a sweet disaster, and traitress. I think that she does that. She'll do that too.
I mean, if you want to just, it's this great thing about Shakespeare, because of course what Parolles thinks he is a traitor, and he's not. And you think, and Bertram thinks he's an adulterer, and he's not. And, you know, there is this trait the whole connection between marital or romantic fidelity and patriotic fidelity is made so clear in this play. It's really only in that Shakespearean way. It's not made clear, obviously. It's just when you start looking at it, it's everywhere. So.
The opposites, there's just gold when he gives you those opposites right next to each other.
Absolutely. Go ahead. I'm not going to let you have the last word this time, Bertram.
Okay, good. Okay. I like this speech. This other side is the more slimy side of Bertram, and it's the last scene after he's really cornered, and Diana's shown the ring that he's given her and everything, and the king says, "She has that ring of you." And I said, "I think she has, my lord. I think she has. Certain it is I liked her and boarded her in the wanton way of youth. She knew a distance and an angle for me, maddening my eagerness with her restraint, as all impediments to fancy's course are motives to more fancy, and, in fine, subdued me to a rate. She got that ring of me, and I had that which any inferior might at market price have bought."
Yes,
this is so nasty. It's great.
Great. Ugly, wonderful piece of venom. It's just great. Yeah.
To go along with If My Heart Were Great, it Would Burst at This, at the end of that speech, he says, Paroli says, "Being fooled, by foolery thrive. There's place and means for every man alive."
I do like that, too. And that could be your T-shirt.
'Tis only title thou disdain'st in her, the which I can build up. Strange is it that our bloods of color, weight, and heat, poured all together, would quite confound distinction. Yet stands off in differences so mighty. If she be all that is virtuous, save what thou dislik'st a poor physician's daughter, thou dislik'st a virtue for the name. But do not so. From lowest place, whence virtuous things proceed, the place is dignified by the doer's deed. Good alone is good, without a name. Vileness is so. The property by what it is should go not by the title. She is young, wise, fair. In these to nature she's immediate heir, and these breed honor. The mere word's a slave, debauched on every tomb, on every grave. What should be said? If thou canst like this creature as a maid, I can create the rest. Virtue in she is her own dower. Honor and wealth from me.
Wow, that is a great speech. Thank you. We'll end with that. And thank you all.
Thank you.
We hope you have enjoyed this Blackfriars Backstage Pass. You can download these programs for free at AmericanShakespeareCenter.blogspot.com or subscribe to all of the ASC's podcasts through the iTunes Music Store podcast directory or through any number of other podcast listing sites. All's Well That Ends Well will be appearing on the stage of the Blackfriars Playhouse in Repertory with William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet and Francis Beaumont's The Night of the Burning Pestle through June 20th. Tickets for all three 2010 spring season productions are available by calling the American Shakespeare Center box office toll-free at 1-877-MUCH-ADO or by going online at AmericanShakespeareCenter.com. I'm your Backstage Pass producer, Bill Gordon. Special thanks to recording engineer Sam Kugler. Once again, thank you for joining us. And we'll look forward to seeing you at the Blackfriars Playhouse.